I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Today on the show, the mass abduction of the schoolgirls of Chibok, Nigeria. Morgan State University and Fulbright Professor Max Hilaire has traveled and lectured extensively in Nigeria, and he joins Midday again to talk about Boko Haram's kidnapping of the schoolgirls. We'll also hear more about the radical group from Amy Pat. She's a member of a terrorism research team based at the University of Maryland. We'll hear what she's learned about Boko Haram. The mass abduction of the schoolgirls has captured worldwide attention, and governments across the globe have pledged help in finding the girls, innocent victims of Boko Haram's war with the Nigerian state. Midday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In the second hour of our show today, some American and World War II history you might have missed. Attacks along the east coast of the United States from New York to North Carolina by German submarines in a six-month campaign that resulted in the loss of more than 200 merchant vessels and the deaths of 4,600 sailors and civilians. This was in 1942. After the news at 1 today, we'll hear from military journalist Ed Offley, who has chronicled the German U-boat attacks on cargo ships along the eastern seaboard in the winter, spring, and summer of 1942. In this hour of the show, we turn our attention to a tragic story in West Africa that has captured the world's attention, the mass abduction of the schoolgirls of Chibok, Nigeria, by the radical group Boko Haram. Governments across the globe have pledged help in finding the kidnapped girls, who appear to be innocent victims of Boko Haram's war with the Nigerian state and with the political community of northern Nigeria. In just a few minutes, we'll connect with Amy Pate. She is a member of a terrorism research team based at the University of Maryland. Amy Pate is an investigator on the staff of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, better known as START. And she has some research to share with us about Boko Haram. We'll speak with her in a few minutes. But we start our hour with Max Hilaire, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, who has traveled and lectured extensively in Nigeria. He was there as a Fulbright professor once upon a time. He joins us here today. It was some years ago, but you've been back several times to Nigeria.
Yes, I have.
Max, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, Dan.
So you've kept your eye on this, and I'm curious about your understanding of Boko Haram, this group. Everyone's curious about the background. We'll learn some more during this hour of the show. What did you know about it, and what have you heard about it during your travels there?
Well, when I lived in Nigeria, Boko Haram was non-existent. So it's a recent phenomenon. Even the whole concept of attack against civilians, indiscriminate attack against Christians or non-Muslims in the northern part of Nigeria did not happen. So this whole issue of terrorism in Nigeria is rather recent in the last 5-6 years. Boko Haram came about as a result of the opposition, a splinter group who oppose Western education in northern Nigeria and probably oppose girls getting an education, period. Much of northern Nigeria is Muslim. Yes, there are splinter groups of Christians scattered throughout the north, but the majority of Christians in Nigeria concentrated in the southern region and the north, which is predominantly Hausa Fulani, and many of them Muslims. So this group springs out of the Muslim population. I don't want to say they are basically an extremist Islamic group, because they may not be practicing Muslims in any way. But I think the activities they in carrying out attack on civilians, bosses, kidnapping children, holding people ransom for or hostage for ransom money, robbing banks, a classic example of just a group that has gone somewhat wild, and they don't really have an agenda that is legitimate.
Your Fulbright professorship to Nigeria was some 20 years ago.
Yes.
I don't want to give us the whole history of Nigeria, but I am curious about the government today versus the government, the country that you knew when you first stepped there?
Well, when I went to Nigeria, 92, I was there as a Fulbright professor, 92, 93 in the Western region, which is Ife, about 3 hours from Nigeria. Nigeria was under military rule. Babangida was the dictator and had the longest transition to democracy. And I was there when the first democratical election was held in Nigeria in 1993. Once the results started coming out and the military did not like the outcome, they canceled the election. Now, prior to the cancellation, the military had even canceled the vote itself, and the Clinton administration came out forcefully and threatening Nigeria if they did not go ahead with, again, the longest transition to democracy, the U.S. would impose sanctions. So the Nigerian military, they flared up. The Nigerian public was very upset about the U.S. telling them what to do, and they expelled a public affairs officer from the embassy. But they still allowed the election to go ahead, and at the same time, the embassy had me do some lectures at the military academy in Kaduna. And once again, as the results started coming out, we monitored some of the polls in Nigeria. It was a free and fair election. People waited for hours despite the misinformation that was going on.
Has that been the case in the years since then?
But since then, Abacha took over after Babangida stepped aside with this botched election, detained most of the Democratic advocates in Nigeria, including Abiola, who is alleged to have won or was in the lead during the counts. Abiola was leading in 22 states when they canceled the election. He was detained, held in detention for years until Abacha mysteriously died and Abubakar, a military leader, took over, put in a rapid transition, held elections, and Obasanjo won, became the president. So Obasanjo, being a former military leader, coming from the Yoruba region of Nigeria, was initially a Muslim, but I believe converted to Christianity. But he was in detention during a couple of years during the Abacha reign. But he was a darling of the West, so it was easy for the U.S. and the EU to recognize Obasanjo, and he became the president, the first elected president in the post.
That was in the 90s.
That was in the
How would you
90s.
Characterize elections since then, the government since then?
It's mixed. It's very difficult given Nigeria is a big country. It's 160 million people.
I have 174.
Okay.
174 million.
It's very difficult to
Africa,
determine,
right?
Because on any given day, Nigerians say there are a million more, but you cannot do an accurate count of the population in Nigeria, particularly in the north, where the Muslim men would not allow you to come into the compound to count the number of people in the house. Second of all, Nigeria is rural. It is extremely difficult logistically to do a house-to-house count. And a lot of people are still born in the homes or in rural areas. So there may be 170, there may be 200,000. The fact remains, it is extremely difficult to do a good count and to know precisely how well you could have an election, because most in Nigeria, to run for the presidency or for any major office, it means you have to dish out a lot of money. You literally have to pay people to go to the polls. And the candidates who run for president are usually billionaires, and usually there are 200 of them running for president. It's quite very different from what we know in the United States or in Europe.
The economy, just a little bit on that. I keep hearing different stories about the growth of the economy of Nigeria, the growth of some other countries. Nigeria supposedly now has the largest economy in Africa, it surpassed South Africa.
Well, that was reported, but I think we have to be careful how we calculate growth and how does that reflect on the overall distribution of wealth in a country. Nigeria, yes, is big. It's heavily dependent on oil. 80% of its revenues come from oil. Much of the oil is sold to the United States. There is a huge corruption in Nigeria. There's a very small percentage of people in the country that are extremely, extremely wealthy. So you're talking about 1%. 90% of the Nigerian population is extremely poor. And the distribution of wealth is very skewed in favor of a very small minority. Of late, there are lots of Nigerians who have returned to Nigeria from Europe, from the United States, and have done very well in this new economy. So it's not surprising the growth rate is growing because indigenous Nigerians are actually starting businesses and doing quite well. But still, there's a lot of the corruption problem is institutional. And unless you can get rid of that, you're not going to get an effective wealth distribution. Second, the rule of law is really problematic in Nigeria. And you don't have a government that is responsive and as effective as we know it in the Western world.
Ah, that leads to my question for you, for your thoughts, Max Soler, about the response of the government to this particular crisis, the abduction of some 270 schoolgirls from northern Nigeria, from this place, this village, Chibok. Parents have been complaining about the government's slow reaction to it. Now governments from around the world are offering help.
Well, there are two things. One, the government was slow to respond to the kidnapping. And the government also, or the elements in the government, to assume that it may be a conspiracy on the part of the states that are in the hands of opposition parties that are trying to undermine the authority of the federal government. I think either way you look at it, it's not going to come out very well for Goodluck Jonathan, who the northern states are not very supportive of to succeed himself in the next presidential elections, which is coming up next year. He became president after the death of Yadewa, who was a northern candidate, and there is an unspoken rule in Nigeria that the presidency should rotate between the north and the south. Given that Obasanjo had two terms, he was succeeded by a northerner, a Muslim, who selected Goodluck Jonathan as his
successor.
His running mate.
A running mate.
But Goodluck Jonathan became governor of Bayelsa State, which is a small state in the Delta region, by accident.
In the south.
Because he was lieutenant governor. The governor of Bayelsa was kicked out as a result of corruption. He became governor, and he was picked by the northerners to be the sovereign candidate because he came from a minority tribe. So they didn't see a threat in him whether he was an Igbo, which is another big tribe, or a Yoruba. And it just so happened he became president by accident.
Okay. But Goodluck Jonathan now is concerned about opposition.
He's concerned about opposition because even the former president.
Why wouldn't he react more strongly to an abduction of these girls?
It's interesting that because in the states where the insurgency is taking place, the government declared a state of emergency in these three northeastern states over a year ago. And there's a heavy military presence in that area. They have. In fact, Human Rights Watch have accused the Nigerian military of committing atrocities in violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. The Nigerian government is also detaining large numbers of young men suspected of being part or sympathetic, loyal to the Boko Haram movement. So that is fueling a lot of anger because the court system in Nigeria is extremely slow. The human rights respect for human rights is definitely not one of the priorities of the regime or law enforcement and the military in Nigeria. So that has created a lot of concerns. And I think the president simply has his hands really tied, and the pride of Nigerians not to have external forces on their soil, I think, was one of the reasons why they delayed in asking for external assistance.
What do you think Boko Haram is after here? Is this completely ideological? Keep girls from attending school, make them slaves, make them wives, or is it to use them as pawns in some sort of negotiation?
I think all of that is part of it. They're using them as pawn. They may be using them as sex slaves. They may be using them in human trafficking, which is a serious problem in many African countries. But Boko Haram has offered to trade these girls for their detained members, and the government has refused. But we really don't know what Boko Haram wants. I mean, it may have backfired on them kidnapping the girls and to see the international public outcry against their tactics. Because all along, the conflict has been going on in Nigeria, and there's been little coverage in the U.S. press in terms of the number of civilians killed, both in the capital and the surrounding area.
Well, we're going to find out more about that when we speak with Amy Pate, who's an investigator on the staff of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, which is based at the University of Maryland. She's part of a research team there. So we'll be speaking with her about Boko Haram. If you have questions for Max Hilaire while he's with us during this hour of midday, please give us a ring. 410-662-8780. And if you just want to express your feelings about this story out of Nigeria, the mass abduction of these schoolgirls, and what do you think the U.S. response should be? 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. You can send a question or comment by email to midday@wypr.org. If you want to see a map of Nigeria, go to my Facebook page. Also find a link to a story today about the situation in Nigeria. A short break. We'll be right back. Yeah, this is the news report. This is Associated Press report saying a Nigerian government official says all options are open, in quote, in efforts to rescue almost 300 abducted schoolgirls from their captors as U.S. reconnaissance aircraft started flying over Nigeria in a search effort. So we have that, and we have some other countries getting on the ground in Nigeria. 410-662-8780. If you have a comment or question about the situation involving the schoolgirls from Chibok, Nigeria. Max Hilaire is with us from Morgan State University. And now we're joined by Amy Pate. She is a member of a terrorism research team based at the University of Maryland. It's actually, for folks who are listening, may be interested to know about this organization, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. We'll just call it START from now on for the rest of this show. It's a university-based research and education center with scholars at work on studying the causes and human consequences of terrorism in the U.S. and around the world. Amy's been focusing on Boko Haram and joins us today. Amy Pate, welcome to Midday. Thanks for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Amy, Max Hilaire is with me in the studio, and he noted that Boko Haram is just not that old. It's probably maybe 10 or 12 years old. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's... Their exact founding date is a little bit murky. They started out more cult-like than terrorist group-like. Dates are usually about 2001, 2002 for their founding date. They didn't really do much other than live in a compound for the first several years, recruit mainly through educational institutions, members, and then when they really sort of exploded onto the scene, especially as it comes to the terrorism, was 2009. They were in conflict with Nigerian police. Their founder, Muhammad Yusuf, was arrested, executed extrajudicially. And then there was a huge push. About 700 people were killed in the Nigerian government response. Some of them were probably militants. A lot of them probably weren't. But since then, their sort of violent activity has really gone off the charts. So now they are one of the most deadly groups in the world as far as terrorist organizations. So since 2009, our STARTS Global Terrorism Database has them perpetrating over 800 terrorist attacks and killing almost 3,700 people. So quite violent.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually,
most of the violence
officially designated by our government as a terrorist organization only last year. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. They got the FTO designation in November. There had been a lot of discussion about designating them before that. The Nigerian government actually requested that we not designate them initially, partially because getting that status is something of a badge of honor among many global terrorist groups, right? Like you're important enough that the United States, the global superpower, is targeting you.
And what do we know about their motivations? What have they stated publicly, this organization, Boko Haram? What do we know from their public utterings?
So they are pushing for further Islamization of the political system in the north. Now, most of the northern states of Nigeria have implemented some version of Sharia law, Sharia jurisprudence. They have Sharia courts. Boko Haram's view is that they do not go far enough. So that's one of their motivations. They also have expressed a desire to expel all non-Muslims from northern Nigeria. That's a more recent sort of grievance that
mm-hmm.
they've expressed.
And the school, as far as the school attack goes, the secondary school in Chibok in this village, this is not the first mm-hmm. attack on a school by Boko Haram, right?
Not by any means. They didn't, despite their sort of nickname, Western education is forbidden, is what Boko Haram sort of means. They didn't really start targeting schools until 2012, so really recently. But in 2012, they had 47 attacks on educational institutions, both primary and secondary schools. In 2013, the numbers went down, probably because there have been lots of closures of schools in the areas where they're most active. But they still had 14 attacks against educational institutions, and more than 100 people were killed in those attacks.
Amy Pate joining us from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, that's based at the University of Maryland. We'll refer to it as START during this show. That's its acronym. And Max Hilaire was with us from Morgan State. We'll take a call. Amy, stand on line with us, and let's see what Kenny has to say. Kenny's calling from Baltimore. You're on Midday. Hello, Kenny.
Hello. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks. What did you want to say?
Yeah, the issue of sectorial killing in Nigeria is not new, either based on religion or ethnic issue and stuff like that. America should play a minimal role in this situation because of the volatile political situation in that country now.
Kenny, are you from Nigeria?
Yeah, I'm originally from Nigeria, but I'm American now.
I see. So you think the U.S. should play
a minimal role to provide logistics
role here. Yeah.
In finding these girls and returning them back safe to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because if America should go too far in terms of making its military presence in Nigeria, it will be translated into another form of colonization. And that may backfire at the end of the day.
Okay. Interesting. Max, what do you think of that comment?
Well, I can understand where Kenny's from, given the sensitivity of the presence of foreign troops or foreign intelligence forces in Nigeria. But I think, and Kenny, correct me if I'm wrong, either way, this is going to hurt Goodluck Jonathan's chances of re-election, because clearly the people of Nigeria, in as much as they would like to see the children release and get back to living a normal life, The situation is, the security situation in the north is such that the military has not been very successful in rooting out the insurgency, and we've had a number of cases of human rights abuse that has really poisoned the climate in the north and made it extremely difficult for the government to negotiate some kind of deal with the Boko Haram. So,
Max, when you say human rights abuses, you're referring to the government?
Government forces in Nigeria. I mean, it's pretty obvious Boko Haram has used violence very randomly and killed law enforcement people, kill soldiers and civilians. But the tactics used by the military in cracking down on Boko Haram has led to a lot of allegations of serious rights abuse violations. And that is something the Nigerian government is going to have to deal with. The U.S. presence, I think the U.S., as indicated, is going to provide some logistical and technical assistance, some intelligence gathering information, the use of drones. But under no circumstances do I think the United States want to interject in the situation in Nigeria, which clearly is very volatile. And given the upcoming presidential elections next year, no foreign government wants to do anything to sway the outcome of that election in either way that is going to make Nigerians more unhappy about the presence of foreign troops on their soil.
Before the break, and before Amy joined us, Max, you referred to use the word backfire. This would backfire on Boko Haram. I'm trying to get a sense of what you mean by that, and maybe Amy has some insight there.
Well, I think the kidnapping.
Backfire
means
you're trying to achieve something.
Because Boko Haram assume if they were to kidnap the schoolgirls, it would basically be a domestic issue, remain in Nigeria, force the government to respond some way or the other. But it has become an international issue through social media, the mere fact that it's a violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. And I mean, it touches the lives of everyone. When children are abducted in school, this should not happen anywhere in the world. So happening in Nigeria, given the circumstances, has really brought a lot of international attention and the response we are seeing. And hence, I think it's hurting Boko Haram's causes instead of helping them.
Amy, how about you on that?
So I think some of the more significant things that have come out of this as far as backlash against Boko Haram, they probably don't really care very much what the West thinks. That's not where they are looking for support. What I think is significant that you had the Organization of the Islamic Conference coming out and condemning it. You've had very conservative Muslim and Islamic groups coming out and condemning it. You've had sort of local religious leaders in Nigeria being vocal about their condemnations of this specific attack. So these are the counter narratives that can persuade locals and potential supporters of Boko Haram not to support them because they have the religious legitimacy to counter Boko Haram saying that we are the true Muslims in northern Nigeria.
Just an observation here, as I'm learning more about this along with lots of other Americans in the past couple of weeks, given the attacks on the other schools, given what we know about Boko Haram and their activities there in the last 2 years especially, I'm really impressed that the parents and the village maintain the secondary school for these girls at all, instead of just, you know, giving up or moving elsewhere. I mean, that's impressive to me.
Yes, but it's difficult to move, especially if you have lived all your life in a rural area in the northern part of Nigeria, which is so very different. I mean, Nigeria is like three or four countries put in one. Yes, everyone is of the same racial background, but in terms of culture, in terms of religion, tradition, the peoples are very different, and they have a strong sense sense of their ethnic pride and ethnic heritage.
And so in it's this not case, very education for their daughters.
Yes, and so and they realize education in Nigeria is taken very seriously because it's your passport for to exit poverty. There are no other way out unless your parents became very wealthy through corruption or being part of the political system, which is corrupt in itself. So people pride education, particularly for their girls. And in the North, where you have a very high illiteracy rate, I think it says something that the women in Northern Nigeria who've been suppressed for such a long time would risk sending their girls to school just to get them an education and a way out of poverty.
Max, go ahead, Amy.
That the school actually had been closed. They reopened it solely so these girls could take their final exams.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I read that. Right. Yeah.
So, which has happened to quite a few of the more remote schools. Mm-hmm. And actually, they were sending students in from even more remote schools to take their exams here, so there was a larger number of students there than there would have normally been.
Amy Pate joining us from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland, and Max Hilaire is chair of the Political Science Department in Morgan State University. Let's take another comment here. Josh in Dundalk, welcome to Midday. Hi, Josh.
Okay, thank you. First of all, people remember, history repeats itself. We're going to send advisors everywhere around the world. We always get involved in other people's situations. If the people don't want us there, it could be another quagmire where their own government is not trying to do anything. Why should we get involved? Why? That's my question.
Well, I would ask, Josh, where do you draw the line between domestic terrorism and international terrorism? The same group could have links with Al-Qaeda. They could have links with the Islamic groups in the Maghreb. U.S. interest is not concentrated solely in the United States. We buy 80% of our oil from Nigeria. There's been 80% of Nigeria's oil is exported to the United States, and it is very high quality oil. The United States has been looking to reduce its dependency on Middle Eastern oil and hence has concentrated on developing the oil fields in Africa. So there's been a lot of attack sabotage on American oil facilities in Nigeria. So you really can't say, well, we should just re-enter our shell and forget about the rest of the world. The United States is a global power with global interests, and hence we need to be everywhere because our interests are everywhere.
Amy Pate, Max made a reference there to Al-Qaeda. Is there clear evidence of Al-Qaeda influence with Boko Haram?
There's certainly evidence of influence, is very clear evidence of influence as far as ideology and some of the tactics. The information around actual links, so exchanges of money, training, exchanges of fighters even, is much more murky and generally emerges from things like people like unnamed Nigerian military sources or unnamed Algerian intelligence officers. So we can be less definite about that, but there are certainly sort of ideological kindred. Mm-hmm. And there have been both on Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb's part and Boko Haram's part, and even stretching across to the other side of Africa, Al-Shabaab, rhetoric suggesting that given the chance, they will collaborate. So there's that. I'd like to add that as far as why the U.S. should be concerned about the situation in Nigeria, for several years now, the U.S. government has been working very closely with the Nigerian government and leaning on the Nigerian government to become a leader within that region as far as counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, counter-radicalization type efforts. They're the largest country, mm-hmm. as far as population. Economically, they're better off than a lot of the other countries in the region. And they're actually quite involved in peacekeeping missions in the region as well. So for all of those reasons, the U.S. being able to work with Nigeria as a local partner is to our benefit in helping professionalize their military, helping train them on human rights, and investing that sort of effort can help us, our interest also in the long run, as in addition to assisting Nigeria.
Amy, thank you for that. And stay with us, please. Amy Pate, an investigator on the staff of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, or START, at the University of Maryland. I said I was going to refer to it as START for the rest of the show, but I keep giving the full name, just so everybody knows, our listeners here at WYPR. 410-662-8780. Dan Rodericks here with Max Hilaire from Morgan State University in Studio A. We'll take your calls and questions about the situation in Nigeria, the mass abduction of these schoolgirls by Boko Haram. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, the midday email address for questions or comments, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. This again from the Associated Press report. According to a senior defense official in Washington, the U.S. is using manned MC-12 surveillance aircraft, which is based in Niger, to conduct missions in Nigeria. In addition to the turboprop model, which has seen heavy use in Afghanistan, U.S. officials are also considering the use of drones. At this point, the surveillance missions are not continuous. This, again, just reading from the latest Associated Press report about the situation in Nigeria, which now has turned into a hunt for these the abducted girls. And we saw a video in the last 24-48 hours in which Boko Haram, I guess, is saying they want to use these girls to negotiate the release of prisoners in Nigeria. 410-662-8780 to join us. Max Hilaire with us from Morgan State University, who has traveled and lectured extensively in Nigeria. And Amy Pate joining us from START, part of a terrorism research team based at the University of Maryland, providing information for us, some background about Boko Haram. And as far as Nigeria goes, I mean, it is a large economy compared to other countries in Africa, certainly West Africa, a large country population-wise. What about its security forces, Max, and its army?
Nigeria has a huge military, one of the biggest in Africa. As Amy indicated, they have been very involved in peacekeeping in the West African region and also throughout Africa. And the United States and the United Nations have been relying on Nigeria to carry out various peacekeeping operations in throughout Africa instead of having European or Americans or Indians, for example, be involved. But I think the military does not have a very good track record in Nigeria because, for one, the military has seized power in Nigeria and dominated the politics for more than half of Nigeria's independence period. They've been brutal and ruthless, and people really hate the military in Nigeria. And there's some, it may be a conspiracy, as the wife of the president mentioned, but the military is dominated by the Hausa Fulani group, the Northerners, and the conflict is taking part in the north of Nigeria. Even the president has indicated that he believes the element in the military that is working with Boko Haram, why they have been so effective in carrying out operations as close as the capital, Abuja, which should be heavily secured, and in the three states where the government has declared a state of emergency. So you say to yourself, how could 200-plus girls disappear from a school where there is a heavy military presence with no traces whatsoever of where they are?
That is an interesting question. Amy, I don't know if you want to speculate on that or have anything to add based on information you have.
So
I guess the question would be, does Boko Haram have some connections to the military in Nigeria?
There is a pretty widespread perception that Boko Haram does have members that are part of the military, not so much at the officer level, but definitely in the rank and file. There are also concerns that they've infiltrated police forces as well. And probably the infiltration of the police forces is worse than the infiltration of the military at this point. Mm. You also have, as far as why the military didn't respond to to this particular incident. We've saw from initially the earliest reports that I saw gave the number of 2 hours warning that Boko Haram was on its way to the school.
Mm-hmm.
Villagers saw him, called local authorities, who then called the military. Amnesty International had a slightly longer time frame. I think they said probably 4 hours. But from what I've seen, they did have military sort of initially stationed around the school, not very many. And this is one of the problems that the military has had in encountering Boko Haram in their attacks, even when they have warning. You're talking about a large geographic area that's sparsely populated, and that even with the widespread military presence, they can't be everywhere at once. And what Boko Haram has been doing is concentrating their forces and attacking with 200 plus militants. And so if you have 15 military soldiers at a school, they're not going to be able to counter 200 militants. The closest place where they could have gotten reinforcements was at minimum an hour away. And that's if they were sort of in the trucks ready to go as soon as they got the call. And so there are real issues in responding quickly when you have poor road infrastructure, the military's not well equipped, and you can't gather enough people to counter the number of people that Boko Haram is throwing at you.
Amy, thank you very much. Let's take another call from another listener. This is Michael in Pikesville. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really appreciate this. And I'm really glad that we're actually talking about this because it's very important. I'm a Nigerian-American, and I just wanted to make a comment, or just two comments, to some responses to some callers that called before. I believe it was Kenny and somebody else. My first comment is the idea of Nigeria basically accepting troops, the presence of foreign troops on Nigerian soil, and that creating the impression of colonization is just not true. Nigerians want help. It's very apparent that we've seen that the Nigerian government is incapable of taking care of their citizens. I lived in Lagos, and believe it or not, this type of incident is really, it's not unheard of, people getting kidnapped. Even local armed robbers, if they try to rob banks, they come in droves. Most times, the Nigerian military is usually outnumbered and outgunned. These insurgents, separatists, whatever you call them, they always have very heavy artillery. And then to the second comment, the caller that said, why should we go and intervene? That notion is the notion of not wanting foreign aid is limited to the Nigerian government only. Nigerians, despite stereotypical messages propagated by the media about Africa, Nigerians, that we value our country, we love our country, we want it to succeed, and we know when we need help. Every Nigerian, if you ask any Nigerian right now on the street, they tell you that we need help. We need assistance. We need technology. We need everything. And at this point, right now, we're only seeing resistance from the government, not from
everybody. Michael, thank you very much. I appreciate your perspective on that as a Nigerian-American. Ebenezer, our next caller in Baltimore. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, the economic dimension has been glossed over. The North used to have a reasonable amount of industry, food processing, textile industry. All of that has gone, the way of the dodo because the government did not invest in the infrastructure and political instability, and lack of power supply has made industry to flee. The young people come out of school, they can't find work. Boko Haram is there. And the people in the military who have been assisting Boko Haram are doing the same out of the economic degradation that took place in the North. By the way, a third of Nigerian economy is now based on petroleum. That process took many years. There's expansion in telecommunications. There's expansion in entertainment industry and all that. That's why they recalculated the GDP. So things have changed. The process of change left people in the North out of the recent development.
Right. Ebenezer, you sound experienced or you're not very knowledgeable. Are you from Nigeria? You're familiar
with
it?
Yeah, I grew up in Nigeria. Huh. And the richest man in Nigeria right now is a Hausa Fulani who lives in the South. He's a billionaire who made his money out of the booming industry in the South. Yeah. He used to be that there was industry in the North. So uneven economic development is part of the problem. It's not just religion. Also, the insurgents in the South have since been pacified because Goodluck Jonathan is from that ethnic group that was very unhappy with the degradation of the Delta because of oil, the oil industry. And now that, you know, Jonathan is president, he took care of them, then Boko Haram is kind of jealous.
Interesting. Ebenezer, appreciate the two very interesting perspectives there. Thank you very
much. Well, certainly the North never really had the kind of development you see in Lagos and further south. There are no natural resources in the northern part of Nigeria. It's very desert-like. It's a huge chunk of the country with a very small population, in as much as they may want to make believe they have the largest percentage of the Nigerian population. But there's no way to tell. If you travel through the north of Nigeria, it's like traveling through the Midwest of the United States. There's just, for miles and miles and miles, there's absolutely nothing but just grazing land, mm-hmm. or desert land. So many of the houses initially joined the military, or they made their business trading in the south and in the southwest of Nigeria and in other parts of Africa. But as Ebenezer indicated, the economic situation in the north is such that many young people who remain in the north do not have alternatives and join in Boko Haram, who can offer them money or a better life, is something that appears to be attractive to them.
Let's take another call. One more call, I think. Uwen in Baltimore. Uwen, thank you.
Yes. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to say?
I don't know. I had a caller earlier. Kenny mentioned the fact that there's always Muslim-Christian feud in Nigeria. And I agree with that. But this is novel. This is different. This is not your neighbor coming in to convince you to be a Muslim or kill you. This is completely different. This is a terrorist group sponsored by outside forces. This is not your run-of-the-mill group. If I'm not mistaken, they probably have some ties with some of the big Muslim terrorist groups, because their firepower, their articulation of Islam, the way they are doing this is a high level of terrorism.
Well, Amy said earlier that there certainly is kindred ideology here, but as far as hard evidence of outside influence, Amy, what would you say about that?
I would say hard evidence of outside collaboration is lacking, at least in the non-classified realm. There may be stuff in the classified realm that I don't know about.
Right, but at least what you know there at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. I thank you for being with us today, Amy Pate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. She's an investigator on the staff of that organization, which is based at the University of Maryland. One last comment here, Amy and Frederick. Go right ahead, Amy. What did you want to say on Midday? Amy, you there?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, what did you want to say? We're almost out of time.
I was just more concerned with maybe a little too late. It's been over a month, and my big concern is, you know, the other girls. So I'm part of them that were asked to be in the trade. There's still a lot that are missing. And maybe girls in the future will now fear going to school because of what has been happening.
Oh, yeah. Well, I agree with that. I was thinking about the psychological damage from this, never mind the physical or whatever would happen to these poor girls. The psychological damage on not only them and their families, but others in that region and those three states and elsewhere in Nigeria.
Well, it's not very different than when you have a school attack in the United States where children are afraid to go back to school and you need to bring in counselors and whatever. I think eventually the government of Nigeria is going to have to boost up security around public facilities in the northern region, around schools, and get on board, as we see in the Western world, where an awareness of a heightened awareness of terrorism is a way of life. And I think for a long time, the Nigerian government was just too lax in the way it addressed the insecurity in the northern part of the country.
Max Hilaire, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, sharing his experience and observations about Nigeria with us in this hour of midday. We thank you again for being with us, Max.
Thanks, Dan.
Always a delight.
Always.
Yep. Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our first hour of midday. Another hour of the show coming up after the news from NPR. We'll take a break here for lunch, provided by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads, and more. Bagby Pizza open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., with delivery available nightly from 5 p.m. to 9.